call this meeting to order and welcome. And before we start, we did have introductions last week, but we do have a new ex officio member with us today, our Ways and Means Chairman. So Representative Solberg, if you would like to introduce yourself and welcome to the committee.
I don't know if that sounds good or bad. Yeah, I'm Representative Lauren Solberg. I'm an ex-official member of this committee. I'll be popping in once in a while when we have an opportunity to do that. My district is District 3B, out of Itasca County, parts of Itasca County, all of Aiken County, and live in Grand Rapids, and this is my 13th term, I guess, 25th year.
Representative Solberg, have you noticed how nice the other members are to you lately?
Well, I always say one thing, Paul, when you look at that, they may be nice, but the number of dogs do to big wheels.
Very good, thank you. We are going to continue on with testimony from the various groups, and I thought this was very important to start off the committee by listing to those groups that work the closest day in and day out with our constituents. And last week we heard from the city groups, we started hearing from the county groups, and so what we're going to do today is finish with the county groups, and then we will hear from the schools and the townships and agricultural area. Yet to come, we will also be hearing in this committee from business, from seasonal rec, and from seniors. Now, is that a list of all the groups that we could potentially hear from? No. But I do think that will give us a pretty good flavor of what the concerns are out there, how property tax issues and policy impacts each of those groups. We also today must be out of here at 9:30. There's a group coming in, so speakers, if I interrupt you, please do not be offended by that. We're going to need to keep to a fairly close schedule, so there might be some questions. So if I do interrupt, it's just for the sake of time, and hopefully you don't take offense to that. So we will continue, and we have Minnesota Rural County Caucus, and Mr. Larson, if you would state your name for the tape there and proceed.
Mr. Chairman and members. Dan Larson, Administrator for the Minnesota Rural Counties Caucus. We are 24 counties, rural counties that operate as a caucus within the Association of Minnesota Counties. So the counties within the organization represent a wide range of counties and demographics. You will find within our group counties that represent growth counties and counties with declining population, those with ag and timber base, and counties that where tourism and recreation are key. So a wide range, as you may surmise, from 24 rural counties. It's a pleasure to be here today to discuss the impacts of property taxes on our member counties. And I'll begin with a little disclosure that I hope that you're not under any false premonitions that you have the A-team in front of you today, because the combination of a heavy workloads from our member county assessors and the distance has precluded them from any county tax professional, you know, to come and assist in the presentation today. So you have me, and I hope you'll be gentle. So upon notification of the opportunity to testify, I queried our membership to try and get an idea of what they saw as the pressures on local property taxes and where those pressures were coming from. And I anticipated hearing back that rate compression resulting from 2001 property tax reform was causing a shift and additional hardships and on first-tier or low-valued homes and businesses. And while there was some of that among some of the responding counties, which I will illustrate in a moment, I have to point out that my survey results were not really adequate in the week that I had. I need to do more work on this, and I'm not going to lead with rate compression and low value and the shift to low valued homes. I'm going to focus on something, on one specific example that's a little different. And extend that caveat that I have a little more work to do in getting the broader picture. So what you'll have today is a snapshot rather than the panorama of our county impacts. So in addition to supporting the AMC initiative on property tax, and we hope you will all review the 14 reasons CD that the counties and the cities and the school districts have put out, you all should have a copy of that. I want to point out that in your packet materials, you should have a couple of letters from two of our member counties. One is Itasca County, which is a growth county in Lake Country, which has many natural amenities, and Clearwater County, which is a smaller ag-based county that might be considered more deeply rural. So we ask each to provide a document for the committee detailing concerns and the drivers on pressures for a local on the local property taxes. I was a little surprised to find out that each of the county pointed to class rate compression as a driver of the shifts to other classification, but and most notably to homestead residential, but they pointed to the rate compression in public utilities, the CI in public utilities.
Mr. Larson?
Yes, sir.
Would you explain for the member, when you talk about rate compression, what you're referring to on that for the benefit of the committee?
Here we go. Class rate compression, as I understand it, is in, from the 2001 property tax reform, class rates on public utilities and CI were reduced from 3.4% to 2%. So there was a decrease in the rate compression. And in that regard, a benefit was provided to those that were in the public utility CI class rate. So if you are a county and you have a rate reduction to a utility, it provides reduced income to your tax base, and of course that has to be made up somewhere else. So that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, thank you.
Just to go over, and in the event of brevity, the Clearwater letter points out in generalized fashion the results that the compression of public utility and CI rate, as I just stated, from 3.4% to 2% provided a 12% cost savings to utilities, but affected shifts of property tax increases of 10% on low-valued homes, 10 to 25%, and on first-year farm homesteads from 60 to 70%, and while other classifications either broke even or did a little better. Now, we have to point out that there were three counties that were recognized in the following year, in 2002, as being severely impacted by this classificator, this class rate compression, and HECA was provided to those three counties to help offset the impact of that shift. And that is also pointed out in the letter. Now, in Itasca County, as illustrated, there's a chart. If your packets are together, there should be a chart on the back. And you can look at this at your leisure, but I'll point out two classifications as you go across the chart, and that would have to do with public utilities and then the homestead. And this specific county does illustrate that the shift from public utilities in the total taxes that were paid in the years 2001 to 2007. If you look at public utilities in 2001, that classification paid 27.3% of the total taxes to the county, and that's in 2001. In 2007, that had been reduced to 12.6%. Conversely, for the same years, homestead taxes have gone from 27.3% of total taxes paid in 2001 to 36.6% of the total taxes paid in 2007. So you get an idea on what some of our counties are telling us. And I did get some different results from different counties. It was a little bit scattered, so I'm reluctant to say that this is something that our counties that is affecting each of our counties individually and in the same way. So I do want to do a little bit more work on this. Mr. Chairman, I can wrap it up. I just wanted to get that point out on these two counties, and then maybe I should just stop there and take any questions.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, and appreciate that summary. Any questions for Mr. Larson? Yeah, Representative.
Mr. Chair, not necessarily for Mr. Larson, but he brought up a point, and I understand that there's a rulemaking procedure going on, again, that are affecting utilities. Okay. And I know, I think in Itasca County, which I represent, we'll have some more adverse effect on the total amount of property tax that are shifted. So I think it's an issue that this committee hopefully will address. I think there are several counties, several areas of the state that are grossly affected by that particular ruling.
Yeah. Thank you, Representative Solberg, and that is correct. That ruling will really make some big shifts in a number of cities, and that is an issue the committee division is going to be looking at. Thank
Good.
You. Thank you, Mr. Larson. Representative Lincheski.
Thank you, Chair Marquardt. Mr. Larson, I know there's a coalition of cities that are similarly situated. I think it's called the Coalition of Utility Cities or something like that. Is that right? You a member?
We are not a member.
Okay, well, I know there are a group of cities who have the issue that Representative Solberg just raised, and I would encourage you to come up with a solution for committee members to consider. I think often when organizations or associations try to find a model that works for everybody, whether it's Itasca or Clearwater, somebody gets missed. And so any input you could provide us, I think the issue you've already raised, the compression, combined with the issue that Representative Solberg has raised, makes it a double whammy for the areas that we're talking about right now. And I think we need some options moving forward for what the different players may suggest as an alternative. And I know that Chairman Marquardt has not prescribed a solution, as has anyone that I'm aware of, but I think we're just sort of struggling to figure out with utility valuations possibly changing with compression, how will we help those cities that really are the host cities for these things we're all benefiting from in the state of Minnesota. And any information you can provide to committee members, I think, will help us as we proceed for trying to find a solution.
Chairman Representative Lincheski, we will absolutely take that under advisement, and I'll put that on our to-do list to tap into the insights of our tax professionals.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
At this time, members, we have a quorum. And I know everyone has thoroughly reviewed the minutes of the January 12th meeting. I would entertain a motion to approve those minutes.
Uh-huh.
Representative Loeffler moves to approve the minutes of January 12th. Hearing no discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say nay. That prevails. All right, thank you. We now have Mr. Carlson here from the Metropolitan Inter-County Association. Mr. Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have a correction. We're now called the Minnesota Inter-County Association to more accurately reflect our membership of the five collar counties here in the Twin City metro area and our eight greater Minnesota members, who largely are the counties that contain some of the major cities or are adjacent to those outstate. I'm going to start off by acknowledging this morning that counties are the largest property taxer in the state of Minnesota, and we have been since 2002, when the 2001 tax reform went into effect. While we're the largest taxer, I think by no means can you suggest that we've been irresponsible in the use of that authority. We, along with townships, have consistently ranked at the lowest levels among the five levels of local government in our annual levy increase. And that's despite the fact that both state and federal actions have been put some extraordinary fiscal pressures on our budgets. At the state level, during the 2003-2004 budget difficulties of the state, either the cost or the actual duties of a significant number of programs were shifted to counties. Among those are the requirement that we house what previously would have been the state's prisoners if they break the terms of their probation or supervised release and they have 6 months or less remaining in their term of the sentence. The cost for placing our residents in regional treatment centers was doubled back in 2003. Even though we had come to an agreement with the state for the state to take over our share of the cost of medical assistance back in the early 90s and had given up aid on a dollar-for-dollar basis for that exchange, then in 2003, the state placed back on us some of those costs, including 20% of the non-federal share of the long-term care of under 65 disabled individuals, and the cost for the developmentally disabled and mentally ill in larger intermediate care facilities and institutes of mental disease. All the changes that you made in the DWI laws, including the felony DWI, going from 0.10 to 0.08, you appropriated money, or your former colleagues appropriated money for the state's costs in the courts, the Department of Public Safety, on the Department of Corrections, but none of the costs that were placed on the counties, which was substantial, was compensated for in any way by state dollars, and consequently we've had to put that on our property taxes. I won't go through the remainder of this list, but want to point to the last aspect, and that's our county program aid, the equivalent of the city's local government aid, is still $20.5 million less than what we were certified to receive in 2003, and we remain frozen at that level. At the federal level, the Deficit Reduction Act that was enacted back last February threatens the loss of what's called targeted case management that we use to provide services primarily to abused and neglected children and to the mentally ill. We're still waiting for final regulations from the Federal Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services, but if our worst fears are realized, over $90 million of monies will be lost to us, and every county in the state has taken contingent action in anticipation of that loss of that money and has, in many instances, increased their levies to counteract the loss of these dollars. Now, they've done this on a temporary basis. We don't feel that we can continue to do this. So either those services are going to be lost or our taxpayers are going to suffer continuing hits. One aspect of the system that affects every level of local government is the mechanics of the state's homestead credit. The graph I show here is a comparison on the blue bars, what's the levy or tax increase on the properties before the state's homestead credit, and then what's the tax increase after the state's market value-based homestead credit. The current mechanics of the system, which I'll go into a little bit more detail later on, are such that most homeowners, most farmers are guaranteed that they will always, I emphasize always, suffer a greater tax increase than any other property in the same jurisdiction. Final thing I'll mention that's driving our property taxes is transportation funding. Over on the left-hand side is the approximate amount that we levy. It does not include the information for Hennepin, Ramsey, Anoka, and one other county because of the differences in the manner that they report their levies. If they were included, you would see that over $200,000 are levied by local governments to manage our transportation system, which is larger than the state's trunk highway system. We're the larger provider of transportation, or at least highway and road services in the state. Compounding that problem is significant inequities in the formula used for the distribution of our constitutionally guaranteed share of the gas tax and motor vehicle registration fees. The counties that I refer to has been in the growth corridor from St. Cloud down to Rochester are at a significant disadvantage to many of their counterparts in other areas of the state, with some of them receiving less than $25 per capita, while other counties in the state receive as much as $600 or more on a per capita basis. The Association of Minnesota Counties has agreed that this formula needs to be reformed. That reform was included in the 2005 bill that was vetoed by the governor, and we urge you to make sure that reform is enacted in any transportation funding package that's subsequently enacted. Now, in terms of what you can do to assist us, well, one thing you can do is assist us with making up for some of the federal cuts we've suffered. I only identified one, or potentially the biggest one, and I know there's reluctance to make up for the foibles of another level of government, but the fact of the matter is, in the area of child protection, child welfare, whatever you want to call it, the state's been really slacking on its efforts in that area too, as this chart shows. The red is what the state's support in this area has, and obviously you can see it's been declining. The result has been the local effort, paid for by our property taxpayers, have increased and filled the gap. County program aid, as I mentioned, that's our local government aid, was cut in 2003. A portion of it was restored, but it's frozen at that partially restored level into the force forever, unless there's a change in state law. We urge you to restore the remaining portion of the cuts made in 2003, and also to index the funding of the system, as was true prior to 2003, as also was the case for city local government aid. I mentioned to you I'd give you some more detail about the homestead credit and why it has that effect of always, always having the effect of making homeowners' tax increases greater than other property types. And the basic fact is the credit doesn't grow with the tax on the property. But worse, the credit actually declines as the value of the property goes up. Right now, the credit peaks at $304 for a $76,000 home. And it pays a substantial portion of the tax on that property. These are examples using the statewide average tax rate. Of the $848 gross tax before the credit, the state credit pays $304 and results in a tax as a percentage of market value, or the effective tax rate of 0.72%. By the time you get to a $350,000 home, the credit's only $57. $250 approximately of that increase is just due to the loss of the credit or its phase out, and that has the effect of making the effective tax rate, again, tax as a percent of market value, 1.1%, or nearly 53% higher than its $76,000 counterpart. This is a portion of the state's property tax system that's begging for reform. Another thing you could do is backfill the cuts, some of which I'd enumerated previously. You had to make them, we acknowledge, back in 2003, 2004, because of the state shortfall. But now with the state's budget back in the black, we ask you to restore one of the first things you do is to restore the funding for these programs. And finally, we certainly encourage you to once again pass a significant transportation funding package. At the state level, a gas tax increase, motor vehicle registration fees, reform of the county-state aid formula on the new dollars that I've already covered, and finally, giving us local sales tax authority, and also expanding the current wheelage tax that's available only within the seven-county metropolitan area, and increasing the authority we have in that area from the current $5 level. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'll conclude and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Representative Solberg.
Mr. Chairman, and said that there was a significant amount in the black. Let me caution people. I don't know where the term significant is, but with the $2.1 billion forecast in November, about $1 billion of that is one-time money that we cannot commit for ongoing programs, unless we want to go into the tank again. If you apply any kind of inflation factor, that takes up about $900 million of the $1.1 billion that's left. So our significant amount in the black is down to about $200 million. So it's going to be a very tight year. And hopefully February forecast will be better, but there's also some clouds on the horizon. So I just want to point out that it's we're in the black, but not with tons of money or $2 to $3 billion is what kind of the rhetoric that's out there. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah,
thank you, Representative Solberg. Any other questions for Representative Paymark?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two quick questions. Mr. Carlson, the Department of Corrections decision to put short-term offenders in county facilities, do you know if that was a cost-saving effort by the Department of Corrections, or was there some other motivation for doing that? Were they just looking to try to...
Mr. Chairman, Representative Paymar, it was clearly a cost savings measure. The $10 million that we suffered in increased costs was a direct savings to the Department of Corrections. They say in their discussions of this that they believe these individuals are more appropriately placed in county facilities rather than state facilities. I would not concur with that because under the state sentencing guidelines, the history, criminal history of these individuals and the severity of their crimes are such that the law dictates that they are more appropriately placed in state facilities. We simply don't have the programming to deal with these individuals who have, committed serious crimes, and it's also a difficulty for us to put them in with our general population. Many who are in there on work release programs or frequently are just in there for the weekends completing the sentences that they've had for DWI offenses. We're just not set up in either programming or in segregation of our facilities to deal with these more serious offenders.
Representative Paymar.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to explore that more with you and when we go through the Department of Corrections budget. Maybe we can do something about that this year. maybe. Another quick question. Does the association have a position on the phase-out of limited market value?
Mr. Carr.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, no, we have not taken a position at this point because the phase-out is substantially completed. It's not as big an issue as it would have been a few years ago for us. We recognize it has had an factor on increasing those homeowners who have suffered a substantial tax increase as well as some of the other properties that have enjoyed the restriction. But at this point, we have not taken a position one way or another.
Thank you.
Representative Lincheski.
Thank you, Chair Mark Hartman. And Mr. Carlson, the Deficit Reduction Act that you're referencing that Congress passed, when you had that graph that showed all the counties and you said, I think it said state and federal cuts combined to have this effect on these various counties, what's the split on state and federal? When you had those numbers up there, how much of that is the federal component?
Ms. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lincheski, all the numbers that I showed on that particular table were just the federal dollars. This is the one health care program, medical assistance program, where counties thought it was so valuable that we paid the non-federal share. We pay 50% of that tab under current law, unlike any other medical assistance program, which the non-federal share is paid largely by the state. The dollars shown there were just federal dollars, not state dollars. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, if I may.
Yep. Representative Lincheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And then on the market value credit, as you were referencing, it goes up in value and then it hits a peak and it falls back off. And the concern you had relative to effective tax rate, if you were king and you could design the perfect formula for that part of the property tax relief, what would it look like? How do you see that working?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lincheski, I got to be conscious of recognizing that you have limited dollars to work with. I'm not ignorant of the fact that Representative Solberg went through. So I don't think you can come up with a perfect system, which I would say would allow the credit to raise with the tax on the facility. But at a minimum, I think you've got to extend the point where the credit starts to phase out. And $250,000, $300,000 before the credit starts to phase out seems to be a much more appropriate and capture a major share of the homeowners in the state rather than what now is a significant minority of the homeowners in the state.
Representative Winchesky.
Just a follow-up to that. So you're more concerned not with the phase-out versus the cliff part. You're more concerned in getting the peak at a higher level?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Winchesky, again, you know, in the ideal world, I would like to see it.
Yes.
But I'm conscious of the fact you don't have unlimited dollars. So practically, I think you've got to do the best you can to deal with the significant portion of the state's homeowners and extending that, and then you're still going to have this cliff, still going to have this phase out, but capturing those in the 76,000 to say 250, 300,000 range is, I think, an important change.
Thank you. Representative Wampler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I think Mr. Carlson's presentation points out something that we don't think about as much, which is we pay a lot of attention to the accounting shifts when we've run into budget challenges where we change payment dates and revenue due dates and those sorts of things, and we've often kept those in mind and dealt with them as times get better. But the list that he's given us of the state and federal cuts, when you look at it, about half of that is actually cost shifts. Some of it is just cuts to programs that traditionally have been provided to local government, and everybody shared in the pain and in the deep budget cuts. But about $40 million on his list are things that have long-term historically been picked up by the state as a state responsibility that were shifted instead as a responsibility to the county. And we don't keep track of those over time like we do the accounting shifts. And I think as we, you know, go forward in budgeting, I don't know, I wish we could look to really positive, wonderful budgets, but, you know, whether we have good budgets or bad budgets, I think we ought to start looking at cost shifts in the same way that we look at accounting shifts, because the net impact oftentimes is the same on the local governments and the people who are picking up the tab.
Mr. Carlson, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Members, we're hearing a lot of new terms, class rate compression, market value, homestead credits, county program aid, limited market value. And next week, and this is a segue into next week, we will be getting an overview from the House Research on all of these things. And now after these, we're going to add now with the school groups another term, equalization, which has had a huge impact on property tax increases. So at this time, we're going to move to the school groups. And just a little bit of history here. In that, in 2001, the legislation was that the state would take over all of the educational costs other than basically that which was voted on upon by the voters. And when that occurred, the amount of taxes collected by schools went from about $1.9 billion down to about $980 million. So it was almost a $1 billion a year property tax buy-down. Now, there was always a little confusion on new funding versus property tax relief, and that's one thing we want to keep very distinct in this committee is the difference between new funding that may go on the formula and a whole different area, which is funding that will go in for property tax relief. And sometimes that gets confused, and we have to make sure that's kept distinct. Since 2002 to 2007, you just saw Mr. Carlson's graph, it's up to about now the levy from $986 million to about $1.8 billion. It's increased by about 78%. So it is in the school area where we've seen the largest increase. And what you're going to hear from members is they're going to tell us now why that happened. So present your name and proceed.
Mr. Chair, my name is Kirk Sion, and I'm on staff with the Minnesota School Boards Association. And I have with me Tom Dean, our legal counsel for MSBA as well. And in your packet, you do have a handout that looks similar to this. It talks about education levies, a spreadsheet like this. And as you know, as an old coach, you steal ideas from other coaches. And I gotta give credit to Tim Strom and the House Research staff on this. And so this is not something that we have created. But the first sheet that you have before you demonstrates the number of local levies, some equalized, some unequalized.
Hold up just a second, please. Do we have that sheet?
It's about the... If you look at this handout right here, it's about the third sheet in. So, very good. Thanks for holding up so we can go over that. Go ahead, please.
Mr. Chair, so you can see with that spreadsheet the number of levies that local districts have the authority to go out on. And then if you look over to the fifth, from the left there, where it talks about whether it's equalized or not, then you can see yes, equalized, and no, those provisions aren't equalized. If it's unequalized, that would be solely borne by the local district, the local residents of that district. Equalization comes along with where the state helps support efforts at the local level, and it's based on your property wealth and your effort to pay. So, for instance, if you're a property poor district, and this is a very simple explanation, if you're a property poor district, a district would receive more equalization aid. If you're a property wealthy district, the reverse would be true, where more local levy and less equalized or less state aid to help that. So you can see that, and that just is simple, just to demonstrate the number of levies that the school districts rely on to help fund their programs. And I also want to point out that if you imagine yourself from a school board perspective on some of these levies, and some of these formulas have not been fixed, and Mr. Deans will talk about that later, is that if you go to your voters for a bond referendum for a new building, a new elementary building, and you tell them that if you go through the review and comment process, you have meetings around the community, and you tell them that the locals will pay about 70% of that and the state will provide 30% equalization to help with the building, and then 5 years later, because the formulas have not been indexed and the property wealth has increased, all of a sudden that property tax component or pressure on your local citizens has increased dramatically because of the formulas that Tom's going to talk about later have not increased or not been indexed. And then the next page shows you a graph on the referendum revenue per ADM, which is the average daily membership or your attendance, and you can see there where prior to, actually up through 93, the amount that was a local levy only, and then the equalization component was added in the mid-90s. And you can see the amount, the levy has gone up over the years, and you can also see, not very clearly, but the state aid component of the equalization. And then also on the next graph, talks about the referendum equalization as a percent of the referendum revenue, and this is what I was talking about, where the percentage at the local level has increased while the state effort has decreased. And so you can see through 2007, where we're at, actually go back to 2005, where 24% of it was aid, and then it's worked its way down through 2007 down to 18% of the state effort and equalization. And then the next page deals with the operating referendum, and this is just data that I want to point out to you on the election totals, where you will see in the middle of that sheet it talks about a calendar year, and you can see the history of the operating referendum and the vote totals and the percent successful, and you can see last year in 2006 where we had 84 districts go out for local operating referendums, where only 33 of those passed and for a low historic low of 39% passing. So that's just for your information. And the last piece deals with the debt service that Tom's going to talk about and some other pieces that we're going to talk about. But the debt service component has been one of the larger components that school districts use to help fund buildings and construction projects. And you can see there that through 2009, especially looking at the debt service aid component, has shrunk significantly, and as a result, if it's shrunk, local districts, local citizens, through their local property taxes, are now paying for a chunk of that. And that's the example I used, where the board goes out and says the state will pay 70, the district will pay 70%, district citizens, and the state will contribute 30%, and then that shifts dramatically due to the formula changes that have not taken place over the years. And we will have a proposal before you that will look at fixing these formulas and indexing those, and I will have Tom present that to you.
Mr. Chairman, Tom Deans. Let me just say, I'm not going to go into huge detail on this proposal today, because when we present it, eventually we'll have the graphs, have the whole deal, explain how it works. And I don't want to try to take Tim Strom's thunder here, because you can't really explain school finance in 35 seconds or so. And Tim will be in and will do a better job on that. Let me just first say that school districts, all their levies are subject to levy limits. We don't have a general deal. If we need more money, we can raise taxes. We operate under strict formulas. Now, there's a couple of these formulas where we can levy the amount that's necessary, but they're for very little items like judgments, unemployment compensation, things like that. But the general formulas that we have, each one of them has a formula, and we can only levy that amount, and we can only get that amount of money, and that's it. Then we're also allowed to go to the voters for anything that's over that, up to a certain level, too. That's got caps on it as well. Having said that, we are looking to get some conformity across some of these formulas. So in the capital area for school districts, we have about four or five different programs where money is available through levies or whatever to fix buildings. We can issue bonds, and there's some debt service equalization for that. We have a program that's called the Health and Safety Levy to fix things up, PCB spills, things like that. We have a deferred maintenance levy. We have an operating capital levy. Tim will be explaining those. What's happened, though, is over the years, these things have come in different bills. Each one of them has a different equalizing factor. So you can be doing a project on one end of your building, and you're getting so much state aid for that. You can be doing a project on the other end of the building, different kind of a project, and you're getting a whole different number, and it makes no sense. It's the same building and that, and it's just because these things have not been coordinated over the years. Now, obviously, it takes some money to coordinate those, but we're going to have a bill that would have a general formula that would be the same equalizing factor for all of those, and that formula would adjust as each year went along, as your market values and that changed, up or down, not just up, but up or down, it would change so that what happened is the original debt service equalization program really came in the 90s. There had been litigation against the state on the constitutionality of the school formulas. And one of the concepts was is that everybody didn't get the same amount of money and the same access. The taxpayers, it cost you more to raise the same amount of money depending on whether you were from a property poor or property wealthy district. The Supreme Court actually ruled that our system was constitutional, but there was enough discussion of this that the legislature said what we're doing is wrong, and they put in these equalization formulas, and they had factors. Unfortunately, those factors have stayed the same for about 15 years. So, if, for instance, in the debt service area, you had about 40% of the districts that got some aid. Now you're down to under 2% that qualify for anything. And, you know, the formula has stayed frozen, and the world has moved on, and we haven't moved on with it. So what we're looking to do is to try to get that back and do the same thing in the referendum area. And we'll have better explanations of this and graphs and the whole thing, how this works, with the presentation coming from those that work in the field. But this is the basis to try to get this so that you treat it the same all the way across the state, and that you have some ability to adjust up or down depending on what happens with market values, so that everyone gets treated fairly.
Well, thank you very much for the explanation on equalization. And in short, what we're hearing is that
the ceilings on these equalization levels have stayed fixed while market values per student have gone up and gone closer to the, which decreases your state aid, and that's probably been a huge factor in the increase in the property taxes. We'll be hearing a lot more because I know there's going to be all sorts of discussion and bills being approached on that. And how we work that out in this committee, we still need to talk about that because we'll be working with K through 12 finance and maybe even a joint meeting of this division with the committee. But I appreciate very much your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Okay. So thank you very much. For time management here, we are going to start hearing from the townships and the agricultural groups at 9 o'clock, so each of the groups have a half hour, the county schools, and the ag and township groups. So, with that, Minnesota Rural Education Association is next, and Mr. Walseth. So if you could keep your presentation to about 3 minutes in case we have some questions.
Chairman, I think I can beat that.
Okay, thank you much.
Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Sam Walseth. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Rural Education Association. Briefly, we're a consortium of about 150 school districts in greater Minnesota. And I can basically say ditto to everything Mr. Schneiderwin and Mr. Deans just talked to you about the school equalization and all of our K-12 formulas and how they have been basically held flat for over a decade now. What some visualizations from your house K-12 staff are coming around, and I just wanted to point those out specifically on the debt service levy about how broken this formula has become. And we're starting to feel a lot of pressures out there in greater Minnesota trying to pass bond issues and take care of some of our building debt. Wait just a second. Mr. Chair, I apologize. I know I was supposed to have my homework turned in yesterday. I got mine done a little bit later last night. The one I want you to focus in on is the graph before you showing the blue line, which is your first-year equalization factor for schools. You can see it's been held flat down there. As Mr. Dean said, about 2% or fewer school districts are now qualifying for that formula, and I think as market valuations continue to rise, that soon there will be no one left on that formula. And the red line is just showing your average ANTC per pupil and showing the market value pressure that's going up. And why this formula is very much broken, and we could really use some relief on that. Mr. Chairman, this handout before you, just to put it in perspective, on the front page, that pie graph showing debt service has 36% of all school district levies. That's the largest share of school district levies out there right now. And so is that the debt service formula is really falling behind. That's a larger and larger share of our total school district local levies that is falling more and more on the local taxpayers. So, Mr. Chair, depending on, you know, what your kind of target this committee has, that's an area where the Minnesota Rural Education Association would really like to see some relief. And we think if we can help make that debt service formula work, that will provide a little bit better equalization, a little bit better relief out there for greater Minnesota. Mr. Chair, with that, I would be happy to stand for any questions.
Mr. Walter, thank you so much. And members, if I could redirect you back to this graph just for a second. And Mr. Walseth has really hit on a problem, as our earlier testifiers did, but the average tax capacity for districts in this state on the average is $7,083 per student.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see the first tier is at $3,200, and the second tier is at $8,000. So you can see where, on the average, almost every district is almost already off the charts and would receive nothing. And that's why on the debt service, only about 1.6% is being covered by the state. And it's just, and if you take on the referendum equalization, the first tier is at $476,000 of market value, and the average in the state is $473,000. So, on the average, everyone's almost off the chart. And that's the concern that we have on that. But any questions for Mr. Walseth? Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We have one more school group here, and that is, I'm sorry, Representative Lincheski.
Thank you, Chairman Marquardt. As they're coming down, I just
I want to ask a question of House Research if I can. I don't know that it's very fair to ask them because it's education bailiwick, but I was really interested to learn that those levies that we just discussed didn't begin until the middle 90s, and often we hear about the Minnesota Miracle solved all these problems, and so since the Minnesota Miracle happened long before then, it obviously didn't solve all the problems, because certainly if these equalizing formulas weren't introduced until the middle or early 90s, they were not part of the system till that point. So I'm just wondering if maybe House Research can tell us, big picture, how much back in the Minnesota Miracle days was getting equalized, and how much of the equalizing factors are actually a new phenomenon to Minnesota government.
Mr. Mike, or Mr. Hines, Madam, or Mr. Chairman, Representative Lencheski, of course, until 2001, the primary levy in the school system was the general ed levy, which was equalized all along from 1971 on, and I don't have enough data to say what percentage of the levy that was, but that was, you know, such a big piece of it that we thought our system was pretty heavily equalized because of that, the existence of that one huge levy that was equalized. I can't give you any more specifics than that right now, but we could look into that further if you'd to get the proportions of those levy shares over time as to when that those other pieces started to become significant. I'm not sure.
Thank you.
Thank you. For the record, I was on the K-12, as members on the K-12 Finance Committee the other day, heard from 20-some school groups. And there were several that mentioned property taxes besides the ones here, and I just wanted to mention those that I heard. The Schools for Equity, St. Paul Public Schools, Minneapolis Public Schools, Anoka-Hennepin School District. So, I mean, we didn't include all of these groups here to testify today, but those were other groups that also had concerns. And so, with that, did you have a comment, Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for the record, could we clarify how many school districts are in the state? 343. And I would just like to point out on that net debt service levy that 300 school districts are affected. So this is just such a crucial issue. This really impacts most of our school districts.
Thank you. So at this time, we're going to hear from the Association of Metro School Districts and Mr. Kroonquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Scott Kroonquist with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts, and AMSD represents 30 school districts in the metropolitan area. About 30% of the students are enrolled in our member districts. And I do have some colleagues with me that are hoping to say a few words too, Mr. Chairman, so I'm going to try to move rather quickly. In your packet, there should be a handout that looks like this. And this is one point we'd like to make. I'm going to try not to repeat the previous testimony from the other school associations, but this one, this graph shows school property taxes on the top, the green line on the graph. And this is not a surprise. You all heard this, and we know you heard it through the fall and during the campaign. We all know that school property taxes have been the big driver over this last year. But the general public might interpret that to mean schools are getting a lot of additional revenue. And as you will note from the other lines on the graph, in fact, the increase in school property taxes has not even been enough to offset the reduction in state aid. And again, we're looking at inflation-adjusted terms here. And so that the inflation-adjusted total school revenue is actually down since fiscal year 2003. So that's the first point we'd like to make, Mr. Chairman and members. Second, I'd like to point to another graph. This is the bar chart that looks like this. The point we'd like to raise here is that we're really hoping that we have better clarity this time around, this year, than we have in previous years in educating the public about the difference between state aid and property tax levy. And I know, Mr. Chairman, I had the chance to talk to you, and I know you expressed you're sympathetic to this concern, and we appreciate that. Coming out of the 2005 session, the big headlines in the paper were that schools received $800 million in new funding. Well, that $800 million broke down like this. You see, actually, the state share of that was $566 million, $95 million was due to accounting shifts, and then actually $139 million was due to levies. And then if you flip over on the other side of that same handout, of that $139 million, $31.7 million was projected to come from the passage of operating referendums. So, you know, we don't think the general citizens across the state got the real picture when they heard that $800 million figure. Finally, Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to leave you with one other thought, and that is, we just want to, and we know you know this, but we just want to really just emphasize that how important it is that your committee and Representative Lencheski's committee and Representative Greiling's committee work closely together, because there is such an interplay between property taxes and school funding, as you know. Just one real example there is, and we know another consideration this year is to do some referendum buyback. It's a proposal that's happened in the past. And you just need to know that does have an uneven effect on school districts across the state. For some districts, that's revenue. And for others, it's property tax relief. And so we're not adamantly opposed to that, but our point is that if that is included, it has to be obviously balanced in some other way to make sure that the needs of all school districts are met. So I would at that stop there, Mr. Chairman, and turn it over to my colleagues.
Thank you. And I could ask for about 1 minute from each, because we're hitting that 9 o'clock time and we're going to hear everyone today.
Mr. Chair,
thank you.
Member Tim Grothall, Minneapolis Public Schools. I'm going to be the designated hitter for the First Class City School District. You've got a three charts in your packet that look like this, and these fit, or I'm sorry, that were just handed out, and these fit very closely with what Mr. Kuhnquist was just saying. The aid losses were not made up by the property tax increases. School districts at Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth have less revenue in spite of increased school property taxes, and then the top line there is the property tax on homesteads. So we're living in kind of an expect more, pay less. The state and federal government are expecting more, wanting to pay less, and the difference is being made up by homestead property taxes. So kind of the no new taxes thing isn't really selling with homeowners in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth. And Mr. Chair, closing with the aid cuts and aid losses and levy shifts in 03, Minneapolis and St. Paul and Duluth actually took the brunt of those, had some of the highest aid cuts and levy increases.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Brad Lundell from Schools for Equity and Education. I'd really like to thank Scott for allowing us to come up with him. I think the one thing you're seeing this year from the school groups is a greater level of cooperation. I think that property tax and property tax wealth has been something that's divided us in the past, but I think right now we're seeing a shared pain in terms of property taxes. And I really want to thank Scott for allowing me to come up and share this time. I've handed out in your packet showing some of the things that Mr. Dean said. Just point of information, I have all this in my computer, so if anybody wants to have their own district done, they certainly can. Just give me a call. Doesn't take long. This shows the growing, and Representative Mark Quart, the chair, also said this. We see that the black line on the left is the state equalizing factor, and that is the growing average referendum market value throughout the state. On the first tier referendum, what does that mean? And the first tier has changed in terms of amounts over the years, but we're seeing on that first tier share that the levy amount that's on the bottom is going up, the aid amount is going down. I'm a little bit, with trepidation, I will say I'm bringing some Senate research in here, so don't throw things at me, but this is a tracking sheet from last year's budget bill, and it shows that for Pay 08, we will exceed the amount that we were doing in collecting in property taxes for schools in Pay 01. Pay 2001 was the state takeover of education funding, the general education amount. And so we're seeing that next year, if nothing is done this year, we will exceed all the savings, the great savings that were brought about by that change in terms of property tax buy-down will be erased and will be in excess of that. Thank you for your time. I stand for questions. And again, thanks to Scott.
Yeah, Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kuhnquist, Mr. Grothall. I just want to be clear, is it your testimony this morning that schools are getting less total revenue in the last few, since 2003, they're getting less total revenue than they got in 2003?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Demmer, that's correct. And again, it's on an inflation-adjusted basis.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah. Representative Demmer?
What rate of inflation are you using?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Demmer, that's using the inflationary index for state and local governments.
Do you know what that is?
Representative Demmer? Mr. Kroonquist?
If the implicit price deflator, we could get to the actual numbers over the years we're talking about. I, off the top of my head, don't know the... It is a different number than the CPI, Mr. Chair, members can grapple. But we could get to those numbers for the years involved.
Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In K-12 finance, we've got different numbers in that, and we are showing increases in revenue, significant increases in revenue going to the state, even including the lesser kids. And I think we need a reconciling of our books, the way it sounds to me.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your testimony. So, yeah, you bet. Thanks. At this time, if we could have Minnesota Association of Townships. And appreciated the testimony from all the school groups, because that is a huge, huge portion of this property tax puzzle that we will be putting together. Please proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dave Fricke, the Executive Director for the Minnesota Association of Townships. We appreciate the opportunity to be able to come before you and give you some information. I feel like I keep hearing echoes in here about the increase in property and levies and those issues. We represent about 9,000 township officials. Their neighbors make up 950,000 residents of the state. We're the kids that are out in the rural areas, some metro, and I'd like to... We're going to have Kent Sulem on our staff, who's our legal counsel, and have Rob Benosik here with us that helps down at the Capitol with some of our activities here to answer any questions. I do want to mention the first graph, backside of the front page of your handout that we gave you, is why I'm kind of hearing the echo that... The one that I want to refer to is actually in the front part of this.
Mr. Ricky, which page are you referring to?
Right there. It's about the second page in.
Page two. It's actually about, okay. Page two as you work.
Yeah, page two is actually in the, about three pages back, or fourth page. But it's the township levies from 2000 to 2007 paid, and as you can see, the metro went from about 11 million to 20 million. The rural area of the state went from about 98 to 188 million. And so it's reflective of what you've been hearing from everybody else, including the cities. The table below that, the chart, kind of shows a massive increase in what the local property taxes are picking up. The other pages there are kind of reflective of what the aids and credits and the deductions that others have talked about. But with that, I'd like Kent Sulem on our staff, who has an additional presentation to make, and I'll give it over to him.
Mr. Sulem.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I am Kent Sulem, General Counsel for the Township Association. And as Mr. Frickney just indicated, the chart on page two of the handout reflects an approximate doubling of property tax levies at the township level since the year 2000. And I just want to highlight some of the causes for that. The most glaring and obvious cause are cost increases for providing services. One of the largest service townships provide is road maintenance. We're responsible for 59,000 miles of roads, more than any other unit of government in the state. And the cost of gravel and the cost of blacktopping has been skyrocketing, particularly in the last year. Blacktopping alone last year cost tripled, mainly because of the oil prices, but gravel prices also significantly increased. That's a major part of our budget. Over 51% of township expenditures are on road maintenance and road construction. However, despite those increased costs, townships receive virtually no state aid of any kind. We receive a small percentage of the gas tax, We received no LGA. We received no HACA. That was eliminated after the 2002 payment, resulting in a $33 million, when you combine those two programs, it's a $33 million impact to township budgets that had to be picked up either by eliminating services or by increasing the local property taxes. That loss of state aid actually reflects a broken promise by the state. Some of you may remember that back in the early 90s when there were some state budget issues, the sales tax was imposed on local governments, and that was supposed to be a trade-off that in exchange for continued state aid funding, we would pay into the sales tax. Well, here we are about 15 years later, and townships are still paying sales tax, but we have lost all the state aid that was pledged as a trade-off. And so it's a broken promise by the state that we hope this committee will help us address this year by restoring some of those payments and making the process equitable. We fully support the idea of fully funding the program. We agree that the cuts to the cities need to be restored. An impact of the cuts the cities have seen is that some of the service contracts they provide to townships, such as the fire contracts, we have seen tripling in the charges that the cities are charging the townships for those fire protection costs, largely driven by the fact that the cities have lost their state aid or seen dramatic reductions. And so rather than having to put it all in the backs of their residents, they put it into service fees and contract fees that we are now paying, and our property tax people have to pay them. So we support fully funding the program, but also revising the formula so that all local governments, including townships, are eligible for the aid on the need basis. Just a couple of things I want to point out as a other increases are the fact that most of the non-taxable property in the state tends to fall in townships, and we're talking about DNR trust lands and that sort of thing. They're in the rural areas, which makes sense. However, we have townships that have 85% of their property non-taxable. State TILT payments have not been modified in several years. And so when you have 85% of your property taken off the tax rolls, the cost skyrocketing for the maintenance, those few remaining private property landowners have to pay higher and higher costs. And so we would encourage that this committee, working with the other appropriate committees, examine TILT payments and help us see an increase appropriate to inflation for those. So the impacts of the higher tax rates have been that in some areas you've got property owners, particularly farmers, who can no longer afford to keep farming, and so they're forced to sell off and subdivide their properties. That results in a couple of things. One is that those property values increase with some of the new denser development and the bigger homes that are being built, but then that puts pressure on the neighboring farms as the tax rates increase and the property values increase. And, Mr. Chair, I promise that to go into the policy side of this when we remain in your office, but that does, of course, have a secondary impact of annexation. And anybody that has questions about that, we'll deal with that through questions. The last page of the handout that was just circulated this morning highlights 8 recommendations that our association would support, and that is restoring the eligibility to townships for the LGA and HACA, fully funding those state aid programs, increasing TILT payments, also considering a possible no-net gain for non-taxable properties acquired by the DNR and other state agencies, reviewing existing state aid policies and future changes to make sure that they don't have unintended consequences on annexation, support comprehensive transportation funding to help offset the escalating costs of road construction, maintenance, and repair, eliminate the unfunded or underfunded mandates, and remember that townships are a little bit unique in the way our taxes are set. Our residents vote for their own levies. They do so at the annual meeting, which will be occurring in a few weeks, the second Tuesday of March. However, the levies set this March are for collection in 2008, which means we won't fully recognize those revenues until the end of 2008, which means we actually have that money for 2009. We need a 2-year lead out. If you're going to reduce any payments or aids, we actually need 2 years to adjust to those cuts. And that's what happened when the homestead credits were modified in 2003 and 2004. And finally, my last point will be to look at the sales tax and restore the exemption for local government. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions? We will be hearing from the township groups later also and during the session. And thank you so much for your testimony. Appreciate that.
At this time, would we now hear from agricultural groups, from the Farm Bureau? And anyone here from the Farmers Bureau here? Good morning.
Good morning. My name is Kevin Papp. I'm the president of Minnesota Farm Bureau Federation. My wife Julie and I raise corn, soybeans, and boys on a farm in Blue Earth County near Lake Crystal, boys being the most important crop. Thank you, Chairman Marquardt, for the opportunity to appear before you and the committee today. I'm here representing Minnesota Farm Bureau, which is a grassroots organization representing farmers across the state. We have 78 organized farm bureaus, and it's safe to say we have at least one farm bureau in each one of your legislative districts. We were asked by the chair to cover the effects of property taxes are having on our constituents. And first, I'd like to mention Farmers Union is also here today. We're going to cover different points, but you can be assured property tax is one thing Farm Bureau and Farmers Union is at the table together on. That has an effect on agriculture, all of us in agriculture, and we certainly are supportive of each other's policy on agriculture. So I'm going to talk a little bit about some of our concerns. Quite simply, one of the things that's happening on my farm and other farmers is they're driving up our cost of doing business. You know, we can do things to try and offset the cost increases in other areas of our business, such as switching to lower cost products or lower cost suppliers, producers, but quite honestly, there's not much we can do about property tax. And, you know, but to pay them, that's really it. In the area of property taxes, we have two major concerns: how property market values are established and local school debt service levies on ag land. We're seeing tremendous increases in the market value of our ag land and property, which lead to higher property taxes. I would encourage the chair and committee members to take the necessary time to fully study this issue and explore potential changes in our property tax valuation system that will lead to meaningful reform for farmers and other property owners in Minnesota. The number one piece of Farm Bureau's 2007 legislative agenda regarding property taxes is removing ag land from local school debt service levies. The current system of funding local school building projects is broken and needs to be fixed. The current system drives a wedge between farmers and non-farmers in rural school districts. This occurs when the majority of property value in the school district is ag land, and farmers are asking to pay the lion's share of the cost of the school building project. The end result in many school districts is the debt service levy bond referendum fail, and the ones that lose the most are the students. And if I would, it's not in my written remarks, but just would make a couple comments on a personal note. Today at 3 o'clock, our local school is done for the week. We are going to have the opportunity starting this afternoon to move to a new school. We passed a bond referendum in the Lake Crystal Walk Memorial School District. We're excited to make that investment into the future, but it wasn't an easy road. I have one that started a second semester this week in college and one in 10th grade. We're moving into the new school today, but our first vote was in 1994. We had six failed referendums before we were successful to upgrade our facilities. As a parent, it's going to be a lot of fun having one son in a new school, but quite honestly, it would have been a lot more fun having both sons in that school for their entire career. Retire high school days, and that just wasn't possible because of the concerns we've had with not being able to pass those bond referendums. So again, we got to remember what's best for the kids. Exempting ag land from local school debt service levies fixes farmers' concerns, but it doesn't address the bigger issue, providing quality education, including facilities for students in rural school districts. We strongly believe that the state needs to provide assistance to local school districts for building projects, especially lower property value school districts. The state did establish a debt service equalization aid program to address the lower versus higher property value question, Unfortunately, this program has not been adjusted to reflect current conditions and is not working as well as it could or should. We encourage this committee to support exempting ag land from local school debt service levies and at the same time provide state assistance to local school districts for building projects. It appears to us that this assistance is especially needed in districts where one class of property makes up the majority of property value in the district. We're very aware of what's happening, what happens when the majority of property is just ag land. But the same way would be true if another class of property makes up the majority of the property in the district. In closing, on behalf of the Farm Bureau members in Minnesota, I want to thank the chairman and the committee for devoting committee time to hearing our concerns and ideas for solutions. We look forward to working with you in the development of meaningful solutions during the session, and we'll be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Mr. Papp, thank you so much for your comments. I'm going to ask you to stay right there, if you would, and have Mr. Peterson come down, and then members, if you have questions for either or one of them afterwards, we'll take those. So now for Minnesota Farmers Union, Mr. Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Tom Peterson. I'm the director of the Minnesota, government director for the Minnesota Farmers Union, and we're, like Farm Bureau, we're a grassroots general farm organization that's been active in Minnesota since 1929, advocating on behalf of farmers and rural residents. And I thank you for the opportunity to speak briefly today on property taxes. And I echo a lot of the comments, as President Papp said, that the issues of property taxes are a main concern for our farmers. When I go out to talk even ethanol or dairy products or dairy policy, two things come up, health care and property taxes. So I echo a lot of the things, even through that the townships and the school districts have said today. First and foremost, when I go out to talk to farmers, they say that their land value, their property taxes have raised in many cases 20-25% in the last 4 years, so every year. So that's a 100% increase, my own taxes included. And that's difficult to sustain and difficult to, as you're trying to farm and keep your operation going and everything, it's frustrating. And you look at what's causing it, and I think you've heard a lot of the reasons. Say the townships did an excellent job of pointing that out. But also in farmland, you know, we have rising land values because right now commodity prices are very good on, say, corn. I think soybeans are going to be good. That drives the land prices. But also, we have people coming to our areas and buying hunting land and buying land for an investment. And that's why I included in my handout today 1031 land exchange fact sheet. And a lot of rural legislators, a lot of our rural residents have asked us about 1031 land exchanges. And I wanted to hit on that today just a minute, because we're looking at, it's really a federal issue, but there may be some things the state could do. And we think that this has increased since 2001 maybe as much as 1,000% in the usage. And 1031 basically is, you could take a apartment building or a strip mall in, say, Representative Dietrich's district, and go down to sell that, and instead of paying the capital gains on the difference, you go down to Representative Demers' district and buy some land. And, that, if you're a farmer in Representative Demers' district and you have to compete against that person with that kind of capital buying that land, it's difficult. And I hear this again and again when I go out to talk to farmers, how are these people doing this? And so we're working to try to tighten up these rules, and we may have to try to do some state legislation, even on trying to get some reporting on how this is going on, because we hear it again and again. Last year, the legislature did pass legislation that increased the value of the agricultural homestead that is subject to reduced class rate. And having it, so it now adjusts for inflation, so that farmers are now paying a 0.55% class rate on the first $690,000 instead of $600,000, which is what it was last year. We had several bills last year that would raise it to $1 million or $2 million because, again, property taxes are high, and if we can lower that first rate, it does help a lot of farmers. And I was always skeptical when I first would hear this from farmers, but as I got doing the math, the average farm size in Minnesota is 350 acres. So if you go into where President Papp lives, or Representative Demmer, where land can go to $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 an acre in some of the places, it doesn't take long on a 300 or 400 acre farm, which isn't a big farm, to get up to $1.5 million, $2 million. And these are family farms. In Representative Marquardt's district, the average size farm in Wilkin County is 1,000 acres. And that's just a different type of farming, but that's the $1,500, $2,000 an acre. This is what puts pressure on property taxes, is these, and so what we can do to help farmers is very helpful. And so we'd like to see that adjustment that was made last year maybe looked at again to adjust even more. Finally, I want to mention two other programs that I put in my packet that are kind of pet projects of mine that I think could work a lot better. They're always, one is Green Acres, which helps farmers, and these are in developing areas. So if you're in near a regional center, or you're facing a lot of land pressures, farmers are always saying, what can we do to help save or get our taxes down? One program is the Green Acres program, and I encourage you as a committee to look at that and make sure it's working good and that our counties and townships are using it, because we hear a lot about our farmers saying, how come I can't get into Green Acres, or how come Green Acres doesn't work? And then the last one is the Metro and State Ag Land Preserve Law. And this law has been around since about 1980, and it pays farmers back a credit, and it's only available it's available statewide. There's two programs. There's a Metro program that's 7 county metro area, and then it's open to the statewide counties, but there's only 3 counties that are in it. I believe it's Wright, Waseca, and Wabasha, or Winona, one of those, all W's, I know. But what it does is it collects a deed, a $5 deed tax on every house sold or refinanced. It goes into a pot of money, and it does two things. It pays farmers back, then it's about $1.50 an acre for some property tax relief, but it also helps preserve farmland in some of those growing areas. So, and because they have to sign an agreement of, I think it's 8 years at least to get out of it, so they're not going to develop the property. And it's a very good program, but I don't think it's promoted enough, and I think we actually could tweak it some that it could pay back farmers more relief. And so I encourage the committee to look at that. We're looking at it with Representative Rick Hansen, and to try to see if there's things we can do. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Mr. Peterson or Mr. Papp? Thank you so much. We'll be working with you as the session progresses. And I also want to mention to members that Representative Demmer is working on ag property tax issues. And if you have comments or ideas and so forth, talk with Representative Demmer on that. So there's all sorts of things. And I think you heard some approaches that we'll probably be looking at is debt service and the rising market values and so forth. One last thing before we end today, and I want to thank all the testifiers for keeping us within the time frame. But meetings next week, Carolyn Chesky has cordially invited all property tax division members who aren't also on the tax committee to two wonderful meetings on Tuesday and Wednesday. Tuesday there will be a house briefing property tax overview. And then on Wednesday, we will listen to the governor's budget presented by the Department of Revenue. And then on Friday, we will have a very thorough property tax briefing by staff members. And I'm also going to try to have Mr. Strom also talk about equalization. So we're going to, all of these things you've heard in the last few days, all of this terminology, hopefully will start coming together for all of us too. So anything else for the good of the order? If not, have a great weekend, and we are adjourned.